How is constant listener Land doing today? I hope all is well with you. Nick Deolius here on the Far Middle Podcast, number 193 of this glorious series of connections that would make Dr. James Burke of BBC Connections fame quite proud. Let's get right into our sports dedication, shall we? Super Bowl week, it's nearly upon us. And we had a recent development at the end of last year when legendary NFL and Super Bowl coach Bill Belichick announced he was going to be the head coach of the University of North Carolina. Wow. A surprising move, not just to me, but to many football fans. And why was it surprising? Two reasons. First, Belichick, he's widely regarded as one of the greatest head coaches of all time in the NFL. Certainly a case can be made for him as the greatest ever. He's got the record most Super Bowl wins at 6 as a head coach, all of course with the New England Patriots. But he picked up his first two Super Bowl rings as the defensive coordinator of the New York Giants, meaning he's got 8 Super Bowl rings as a coach and coordinator. That's the most for anybody, player or coach, ever in the NFL. He was also in 4 Super Bowls as a coach or coordinator where he experienced a loss. So that means he was in 12 Super Bowls overall, and Belichick has the most playoff coaching wins all time with 31. During his tenure with the Patriots, Belichick was the brains of the organization. He built one of the great dynasties that basically reigned from about 2001 to 2019. And you know, the only constants of success over that time of dynasty was the owner Bob Kraft, the quarterback Tom Brady, and coach Bill B. So the greatness of Belichick, that warrants surprise that he made a jump late in career and late in life to coaching college. But there's a second reason why it surprised me. He ranks 3rd in career regular season coaching wins in the NFL. He's got just over 300, 302 to be exact. Now, number 2 on that all-time win list for regular season is Papa Bear Halas, who was episode 183's dedication subject. He's at 318 wins, meaning Belichick's only 16 wins back from Halas for the number 2 slot. The number 1 all-time holder of the record is Don Shula. He's at 328. That means Belichick is only 26 wins back from the top slot. So if he's jumping back into coaching at this late stage of career, I would have expected to jump back into the NFL to run down that all-time career regular season wins record. But then again, this is Belichick, and he is a football nerd. He might be more intrigued with giving the college game a whirl to see what it's like or if he could succeed in it. Something new and a new challenge. And when you've got 6 Super Bowl rings as head coach and then 2 more as a coordinator, you probably don't have much left to prove in the NFL. Been there, dominated that, so to speak. Thus, Far Middle episode 193 goes to Bill Belichick, his domination of the big game at the NFL level, and his willingness to jump into a new experience as a head coach at UNC at the college level at a young age of 72. Our first connection will go from coming up on a Super Bowl, an event Bill Belichick dominated, to what we just came off of or came from, a presidential inauguration, an event featuring President Trump, who came off an election he, if not dominated, certainly exceeded expectations with. The new administration's focus on improving government efficiency and pulling back onerous regulation, it's exciting to someone like me who is a combo of libertarian, socially liberal, and fiscally conservative. And it also has a theme that obviously resonated with voters across America on Election Day. I came across a poll that must have been taken right around Election Day that showed most American voters are more worried about government interference in private affairs than about the danger of capitalism and free markets. Our friends at Gallup, they performed the poll and they found that 55% of voters believe government is doing too many things that should be left to individuals and to businesses. And only 41% of voters felt that that was not the case. The Chamber of Commerce also sponsored a survey. This was earlier in 2024. They found the voting public is more concerned about government micromanaging private business than it is about allowing business to make decisions that they think are best for their customers, even if they don't align with the personal views of the respondents. I think both Gallup and the Chamber of Commerce, they nailed the sense of most of the American public with these studies and polls. And I think President Trump was able to do the same, and it manifested in his election performance. But now it's time to follow through with tangible action to put these fears of most Americans to rest by reining in the administrative state so that it falls within bounds more in line with reasonableness and our Constitution. For our next connection, we don't need to jump far from the prior topic. In fact, we can just move a step further to discuss a related issue, perhaps the same issue, just in a slightly different context. Once again, with this new administration now in office, expect big changes to come down the pike with respect to government accountability in the administrative state. And if you've listened to just a single episode of The Far Middle, you inevitably know I'm excited for such a development, and I've been quite anxious for this to occur. And it doesn't make me MAGA. It just shows, again, my libertarian, socially liberal, fiscally conservative slant, and that a small and a competent government that doesn't get in the way of the individual freedom and of private enterprise, that's the way to go. Now, one area of the federal government that might see substantial change and reform, and this can't come sooner enough, is the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. The focus area is going to be instructing the NIH to take on the campus culture found at many elite universities. And it stands to be able to do so by the power of the purse strings. There are tens of billions of dollars in scientific grants that the NIH doles out to universities on a regular basis. Now, the idea is to link likelihood of research grants to objective and quantitative rankings and measures of academic freedom on campus. Now, if you read my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, you know I'm in total agreement with that idea. Because currently, elite academia and the scientific research that it performs, they're mired in a culture of conformity, one that ostracizes dissenting views or unconventional thinking from the consensus. We see that occurring across every imaginable arena of scientific research, and then we see that research setting every imaginable arena of policy. And that's how you end up with a whole host of issues imposed by government that arrogantly references as reflecting the science, but that defy the core principles of math, chemistry, physics, biology, and most of all, common sense. So hello, pandemic lockdown policies and social distancing and many climate policies that we've seen come down the road. Schools where students feel more comfortable, or researchers who feel more comfortable expressing ideas, and where faculty are not sanctioned for expressing opinions, and where speakers are not disinvited because of controversy, they're the schools where academic freedom reigns free. And those are the schools where the taxpayer would receive the best return on investment for research grants from the NIH. It's logically simple. But that's not what's occurring today, or at least prior to the current administration. The University of Pennsylvania, the University of Southern Cal, Columbia, they've got incredibly poor rankings when it comes to freedom of speech and expression, yet they receive massive grants from the NIH to perform research that might be adversely impacted by ideology. Another idea that will be an area of attention with the new administration and the NIH will be pursuing a correlation of study funding with the ability to replicate work of other scientists. The idea is to use replication to expose research fraud, which has become a massive problem in the scientific community. Along with that would go transparent commentary and feedback on studies published in scientific journals where everyone can read what others in the field think or what their assessments are of the research or the paper. And there's also an idea being floated to institute term limits for scientists running the NIH various research institutes and centers to avoid siloed and entrenched thinking. Critics of this approach, and there are many to be found in the establishment, they cry that we're politicizing science and research and that that's going to slow progress or discoveries. That's hogwash for a couple of reasons. First, these proposals would not impose political ideology upon elite academia or researchers. Quite the opposite. Instead, it would demand freedom of speech and expression and thought. And that's a win for science and innovation. Second, these proposed reforms are advocating and imposing transparency across the system and the process of research. Last time I checked, transparency is a fundamental prerequisite for effective scientific research and discovery. We're not picking a pope in a secret ballot. We're looking to optimize a process that innovates, discovers, and demonstrates key advancements in the most efficient manner and time possible. The more people are in the know, the better. And finally, current system and culture as to how NIH awards research dollars and how elite academic institutions perform research, they're far from perfect. Check that. It's an embarrassing mess. Sensible reforms such as these, they pose effectively no downside, but they offer massive upside to society and taxpayers, who are the ultimate beneficiaries for whose such research is conducted and funded. Speaking of the need for society to advance the state of the art within research and innovation, let's make a connection to discussing the pipeline of talent development to grow the next generation of world-class STEM professionals. Came across a story about Thomas Jefferson High School in Fairfax County, Virginia. For a while now, that high school enjoyed a reputation as, if not the best, one of America's top science and engineering and math schools. They say sometimes in life, success is often imitated, and at times it might draw the flies in the form of bad influences. Well, unfortunately, both seem to be the case with Thomas Jefferson High, because the Chinese Communist Party and entities affiliated with it, or maybe more appropriately, entities controlled by it, they bought the high school's curriculum and copied its model numerous times across China. Some report up to 24 clones of Thomas Jefferson High Schools exist in China today. And interestingly, they are called or known as Thomas Schools in China. In the last decade, a handful of Chinese institutions affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party, they gave over $3 million to a nonprofit entity that's affiliated with Thomas Jefferson High School. Now, what was asked for in return? Did Thomas Jefferson High provide its curriculum and its floor plans and any of its proprietary knowledge back to the institutions from China who made the donations? That's how China was able to copy the high school's model across its country. There's a parental advocacy group that claimed last year that the Thomas Jefferson High School administrators improperly designated the $3+ million in donations, so to speak, as charitable. The reality was that it was an exchange of value for value, with the entities providing the money receiving in return the ability to copy the high school in its totality, the school's blueprint, so to speak. Virginia's Department of Education is investigating the situation, and last I heard, the state's attorney general is also assessing the situation. And this is another example in a long line of similar murky and fishy arrangements between the Chinese Communist Party and American educational institutions. Heck, what's going on with Thomas Jefferson High School? It's child's play and small potatoes compared to what's going on between the Chinese Communist Party and its bribing and buying of American universities. It represents perhaps the largest bought transfer of technology and know-how in human history, and what will prove to be a strategic boon for China's economy and military, along with, of course, its global ambition. China already graduates more engineers than the rest of the world combined. And now it seems to be looking to manufacture a massive supply chain of STEM professionals at even earlier stages and ages with its Thomas Schools for pre-university students. China and the United States competing for best-in-class STEM programs. It leads to our next connection, which deals with how many young professionals we can expect in fields like STEM to enter the workforce, and how that expected level of entry compares to those current professionals that are exiting the STEM workforce via retirement. Perhaps some exiting way too soon or too early of an age. We talked an episode or two back about the mathematics of population demographics of developed nations. Do you remember that? The statistics where we discussed working age citizens to retired or elderly citizens in nations spanning from the United States to Japan to China, European countries. Well, I came across something recently that would be a great single illustration of that math statistical challenge at play, but on a personal story or dynamic basis. This was in a national newspaper, and the story was explaining what it was like for an American to retire in Europe, and particularly with this story in Belgium. Now, I'm sure you've seen stories in newspapers or on the internet that are similar. Someone winding down their career and retiring not to watch the grandkids or to move to Florida and golf more, but instead to drop everything here and to start anew in some exotic European locale. Now, this story was similar, but was interesting for this discussion point on the far middle, especially the details. The gentleman made the jump to Belgium a few years back after his physician, his doctor, told him that his job was having adverse impacts on his health. He was an IT director at a public university in California, and he was logging in serious hours during the typical work week. Now, he had a few things going for him that would allow him to consider a retirement and a move to Europe. He was single, he had no kids, so he made the jump, and he took advantage of his relative freedom. He was 50 years old, and he had the option of an immediate pension through early retirement. He jumped over to the UK and took up a geology course at Oxford, but then the pandemic shutdowns occurred, and at the time, he was stuck in Belgium. And he liked his time there under lockdown so much that he decided to call Belgium home. Now, one of the hurdles he had was to show proof of regular income. The Belgian government, the EU, needed to see that for him to stay on an extended basis. No problem there for him because he had his California University pension that served that purpose and satisfied that condition. And he also had health insurance coverage from his retirement and prior employment, and his annual copay was quite reasonable and his deductible was modest. So he seems to have taken full advantage of his retirement in Belgium, and good for him. He's got an apartment in the city center. It's got great views. He pays significantly less in rent than he did in Cali. He attends neighborhood fairs and parties along with music festivals and other types of events. And his typical day starts with coffee and croissants from the bakery across the street. He takes walks to exercise, checks out new exhibits in Antwerp's awesome museums, and he makes his own gourmet pizzas with Italian flour and local ingredients, which got me excited. He goes to a farmer's street market on the weekends, and he'll have the obligatory Belgian beer at local cafes. And he's taken up painting with his newfound free time in retirement. He uses public transportation. He loves it. And he uses it to see other cities within Belgium and beyond. My point is not to criticize this individual. It appears he's worked hard in his career. He's living the life he wants to live, and he seems to be enjoying it. More power to him. But his example is illustrative of a major problem that goes back to the demographics and the statistics and the financial math of cities, states, and our nation. Allow me to explain. The point is quite simple. The system, from states like California to universities, to generous healthcare, to early pensions, it's all working in concert to incentivize, to the brink of shoving out, workers at their professional productive peak and in the prime, and to hang it all up, exit the workforce, and go from an individual that produces resources for society to one that now begins to draw upon resources from society for entitlement promises and payouts. And that makes the demographics of productive current workers to non-workers and retirees worse. And it makes the financial math of revenue generated in an economy and for a government versus entitlement promises paid out by the government much worse. When the starting point's already at or near crisis levels, examples like this gentleman may prove to be the tipping point to push things from crisis mode into irreparable mode. Again, don't blame the individual in this dynamic. Blame the system that does not just allow it, but that promotes it. Because the system's creating outcomes that lower worker productivity, that reduces our competitiveness, that harms customers, such as students in this example of the university IT professional, and that bilks taxpayers by denying them better bang for the buck. Government should be aiming for the opposites of those things instead of creating a system or programs or policies that reinforces those things. Indeed, reversing the system and its policies that incentivize further erosion of our already shaky worker demographics is a must if we are to avoid math that doesn't allow our economy to function when one looks to tax revenues raised versus entitlement spending flowing out. Even with as much needed reversal, it might still take a miracle to right the fiscal ship. Well, speaking of miracles, and considering it's time to wrap up our week's episode, let's make a final closing connection to miracles of a different kind. Musical. On our air day, January 29, back in 1972, the Motown icon Smokey Robinson left the Miracles. It sort of rivaled the Beatles breaking up. William Smokey Robinson Jr. was and is an American Renaissance man from the Motor City, a singer, a songwriter, record producer, and record exec. He did it all in the music biz and changed it. He was the founder and frontman of the pioneering Motown vocal group The Miracles, for which he was also the chief songwriter and producer. That group dates back to 1955, when it was named the Five Chimes, and until 1972 when he left the group. He left because he wanted to focus on his role as Motown Records VP, but Robinson returned to the music industry as a solo artist the following year in 73. Smokey has a lot of hardware honoring his career on his shelves. He's been inducted in, of course, to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That was back in the late 80s. He was awarded the 2016 Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for his lifetime contributions to pop music. He's got a double pair of Hollywood Walk of Fame stars, a double inductee, both as a solo artist and as a member of the Miracles. So he's got two stars in Hollywood. And are you wondering how Smokey got his nickname? Well, I've got a story straight from the legend himself. This is Smokey's words. My Uncle Claude was my favorite uncle. He was also my godfather. He and I were really, really close. He used to take me to see cowboy movies all the time when I was a little boy because I love cowboy movies. He got a cowboy name for me, which was Smokey Joe. So from the time I was 3 years old, if people asked me what my name was, I didn't tell them my name was William. I told them my name was Smokey Joe. That's what everybody called me until I was about 12, and then I dropped the Joe part. Yeah, he basically created his own nickname, which I thought was breaking a cardinal rule of nicknames. They need to be placed upon you by others, not picked by yourself. But, you know, this is Smokey Robinson, and he can do what he wants and be called what he wants. So there. Now get this. He and Aretha Franklin lived several houses from each other in Detroit, I believe on the same street. Can you imagine that? He said he'd known Franklin since she was about 5 years old, overhearing her play the piano when he had come to play with her older brother. Man. Now, I said Smokey was a songwriter. Listen to the Motown legendary hits he wrote in the 1960s that were performed by others. He wrote My Guy for Mary Wells, The Way You Do the Things You Do, My Girl and Get Ready for the Temptations. There's three epic hits right there. Don't Mess with Bill for the Marvelettes, and Ain't That Peculiar for Marvin Gaye. Think about that. A legend writing legendary songs for other legends to perform, all under a legendary record company. Okay, what's your favorite Miracles song? Well, for me, it is Tears of a Clown. That's an easy choice. And of course, it's one of the all-time greats in music history, period, at least in my book. Favorite Smokey penned hit performed by another act? Well, I listed some great ones there prior. I'm going to go with Get Ready by The Temptations. Best Smokey solo song? Cruisin' for me. Brings back memories of AM radio playing in a family car as I was riding in the back as a kid. And how about the best Smokey tribute song? There's a few of them. I'll pick the 1980s group ABC with When Smokey Sings. That's an underrated song there, constant listeners. Give it a listen. By the way, Smokey, I think, owns a home in Pittsburgh. So I'm going to keep my head up and see if I run into him someday around town. And you keep your head up this week. And as always, stay connected to that far middle.